getting to know her is simply through her book. It came in pregnancy, but being one who was brought up on history and gave up doing any history long before school ended, it was through Winston Smith. And to read a history book on ancient Egypt, more or less by accident, written by Professor Ramana Thapa, was sort of quite an eye-opener. And to all of you who know her, know what a new interpretation of history is possible. And the original way these books have been written. Now, I don't want to take any more time, but I'm very grateful to Professor Ramana for having accepted to come here. I thought we were taking her away from a long place to visit, but I suddenly discovered this afternoon that she was more or less brought up in Pune, not quite born and brought up. And she knows the city very well, and she was very happy to be here again. So thank you very much, and I apologize.
Thank you, Professor Ramana. Friends, I must confess at the start that when I was asked to consider giving 5 lectures on history, I was really stuck. I couldn't think of which 5. I tried all kinds of permutations and combinations, including what I thought would be rather dull if I just went through the whole range of Indian history, as it were, starting with the Harappa culture and ending up with 1947. So I decided that instead of that, which you can, the narrative account of Indian history, which you can read in very many books that are now available, instead of that, I thought that what I should concentrate on is the interpretation of Indian history, which in a sense has its own history, which has its own problems of a very particular kind, and the kind of difference in approach that Dr. Ramana was speaking about, mentioning earlier, is really a difference that has come about very much through the study of what we call historiography, or the interpretation of history. As it happens, I thought that perhaps the best way of proceeding with these 5 lectures is that I would speak today and tomorrow on the way in which Indian history was looked at, perceived, in the 19th and 20th centuries, that today I would speak largely about the beginnings of the way in which Indian history was written, largely by European scholars and mainly British at that, ending up inevitably with Winston Smith. And then tomorrow I will go on to speak about Indian historians, in a sense reacting to this interpretation by European scholars, in a sense developing the argument much further. And then the last 3 lectures I would like to take up. The third lecture will be a kind of general overview of the more important aspects that we as historians are concerned with these days. And the last 2 lectures will be specific studies relating to problems of contemporary interest which have a historical bearing. And one will deal with the notion of communalism, which is, of course, politically a very central notion these days to Indian society, unfortunately, but there it is. And lastly, I thought I would end up with something of much more entertainment value, namely an analysis of the different versions of the Ramayana, since the Ramayana has been something very much at the forefront of the media, at least in the last couple of years. Now, let me start, therefore, with today's talk, which will be essentially on the way in which European scholars looked at Indian history. Let me begin by saying that one of the major changes that has occurred in the study of history is, of course, that history is no longer seen merely as the recital, as it were, of dates and events, of a sequence of events, of a narrative of events. History is really seen now as the attempt to reconstruct a culture. And by culture, again, I am not using this term in the conventional sense of culture with a capital C, referring to philosophy and literature and the arts and architecture, etc., etc. I am referring to culture very much in the sense in which it is used today in the social sciences, namely a way of life. In other words, the historian is concerned with reconstructing the way of life of the past. And let me also complicate this further by saying that there isn't a single way of life, there are many ways of life. And consequently, in a society, and particularly in societies as complex as Indian society, we talk about the many ways of life conditioned by environments, by castes, by religious sects, by political interests of various kinds. We therefore also talk about the many pastes of Indian society. In other words, historians are not concerned only with the past of kings and elite groups, but they're also concerned with the past of a wider spectrum of people. And as I shall go on to explain in the lectures tomorrow and the day after, much of this information on the wider spectrum of Indian society comes not only from literary sources, the general idea of the general basis of historical information, but much of it comes from new kinds of sources which were essentially developed in the 20th century, such as archaeology in its many manifestations. Now, history, therefore, is the reconstruction of cultures, and therefore we're concerned today with the way in which European scholars looked at Indian history and tried to reconstruct the different levels of Indian society and the Indian past. The first thing to remember in this case is that the arrival of European scholarship created a break in the tradition of recording history from the way in which it was recorded in the pre-European period, that is the period prior to the 18th century, and the way in which it came to be recorded in the late 18th century. The break, in fact, is so fundamental that there are many historians who refer to it as a disjuncture. This is, in fact, a cultural disjuncture. Society in India ceases to see itself in the way in which it saw itself traditionally, where things like genealogy, caste, interrelations between social groups were of fundamental importance in the writing up of the past, where concepts of time were both cyclic as well as linear, where notions of time varied very much according to situations. All of this was given up, as it were, and there was a movement towards what one might call a uniform interpretation, uniform concepts of time, and a uniform understanding of the past. And this was, in fact, a very major disjuncture. A major disjuncture because this uniformity was a uniformity which was imposed on Indian society and grew out of the perceptions which European scholars had of Indian society based on their own intellectual preconditions. There were very few among them who actually looked at Indian society in terms of the Indian given. Most of them tended to look at Indian society in terms of all the preconceptions that they had been brought up on in terms of European history. They were looking, therefore, as Europeans at the Orient. They were also looking at what has become a very popular phrase now in anthropology and intellectual history. They were looking at what is called the other in quotation marks. The other person, the other society, the other culture. Something that is alien, that is different, that has to be comprehended. But they were looking at this other society not in terms of what were the preconditions from that arose from this other society, but in terms of the European preconditions. And I hope to be able to demonstrate this as we go along. There is the recognition of difference, of strangeness, of alienness. And this recognition is very often emphasized and stressed in the theories of explanation that are brought forward. The concerns, then, that we will be dealing with today are largely the intellectual concerns of Europe and how they applied to the Indian situation. Tomorrow, of course, we shall look much more clearly at the Indian concerns with the Indian situation and see what happened to the interpretation of history. There is, first of all, in this late 18th century, early 19th century understanding of Indian history, a denial of a sense of history. It was argued that Indian society was an ahistorical society because it did not produce the obvious kinds of historical writing that existed in Greece, that existed in China, works of people like Herodotus, Thucydides, Xenophon, and so on in Greece, and the chronicles of Su Ma Xian and so on in China, or even the famous Muqaddama of Ibn Khaldun, which was something that grew out of Arab philosophy and ideas. And the argument was that the Indian society was peculiar because it was ahistorical, an argument which some of us are trying to investigate and perhaps contradict if we can succeed in doing so. But the reconstruction and the discovery of knowledge about India was extremely crucial to colonial power and colonial attitudes. Because it was argued right through the 19th century that knowledge is a form of power. If you can comprehend a society, if you can comprehend a situation, you can control it. And the most famous phrase, of course, is the phrase of Lord Curzon in the very early 20th century, where he talks about the discovery of the Orient, and particularly the discovery of India, was the necessary furniture of empire. And I think this is really, in some ways, nasty as it is, a very felicitous phrase, because it really sums up the attitude that many of them had towards this whole question of the knowledge of the Orient. Now, history in Europe undergoes a tremendous change after what is called the Renaissance, after the 15th century, when there was this tremendous rediscovery of learning, going away from the Catholic Church, back to the roots of European culture in the Mediterranean, in the civilizations of Greece and Rome, and the history of Greece and Rome. And it was at this point that you get the reconstruction of European history changing very definitely towards a chronology, an interest in chronology. Chronology became absolutely crucial. If anybody talked about history, they had to first of all explain exactly at what point in time something was happening. History was otherwise regarded as non-existent unless there was a chronology. And secondly, a narrative of events, which became very crucial to the study of history. Let us jump from the 15th century to the 18th century and see what is happening in Europe. The 18th century, the century of the French Revolution, the century of the great intellectual enlightenment that went a little prior to the French Revolution, the century which also saw the spread of Spanish and Portuguese power in Latin America and in different parts of Asia as well. There is in Europe a tremendous interest in the outside world, an interest which is motivated by two factors in the main. One is the gradual decline of the orthodoxy of the church. Remember that the Reformation has taken place, Protestantism has come into existence, and Protestantism is giving a great boost to the idea that you get away from conventional knowledge, you experiment, and you look for new areas of knowledge. A boost that only lasts up to a point, because Protestantism also, like most religious ideologies, develops its own orthodoxy and gets entangled in that by the 19th century. But in the 18th century, there is this search for new fields and pastures, new as well, and a tremendous outlook on the world where, of course, the world is slowly coming into the orbit of European interests. And it's coming into the orbit of European interests on the basis of what has recently been described as the world system of capitalism, which begins in the 18th century with European trading companies going out to Africa, to Asia, primarily to Asia, the Spanish and the Portuguese having already established colonial control over Latin America. The beginning of the 18th century sees a gradual movement of the Northwest European countries like France, England, the Dutch, the Danes even, going out and looking for trading bases in Asia. Mercantile capitalism, which has its heyday in the 18th century. Within European cultural traditions, it is also the period where the Europeans are searching for their own identities. A very crucial period where the aristocracy of Europe has been overthrown by the French Revolution, is going to be further overthrown in the 19th century. These are all preconditions to movements towards the overthrowing of aristocratic groups and the coming in of what is sometimes called the bourgeoisie, the middle class. They're the people that are slowly coming into power and control. And in a sense, emperors like Napoleon was very much a bourgeois emperor. He has no aristocratic basis at all, although he later on, he and his brothers marry into the aristocracy of Europe. They are in fact very much people of the soil who are gradually elevated up. The search for identity is extremely important because do keep in mind the fact that much historical motivation is a social group searching for its identity. And as the social group comes into power, comes into authority, its need to have an identity, its need to have a historical root and an evolution to that point of power is extremely crucial, and consequently identity is a very important factor in the study of history. There was also in the 18th century a famous movement in literature in Europe called the Romantic movement, a movement away from the formality of classicism, a movement which demanded a freedom of expression in poetry, in art, in every form of articulation, as it were. And this movement, in Germany in particular, was very concerned with the identity of Northwestern Europe. Where did it all begin? The one area, one answer was that it all went back to Greece and Rome. But the Northwest Europeans, who were now forging ahead and were doing things much more interesting than what the Portuguese and the Spanish and the Italians might have been doing, are beginning to search for a new identity, and they're looking at their past. And they're looking away from Greece and Rome, they're looking at Central Asia, they're looking towards India. And there is, within this Romantic movement, a great enthusiasm for things Indian. Indian philosophy, the learning of Sanskrit, which is very, very uncertain in the 18th century, but nevertheless picks up in popularity. And there is gradually the building up of an image of a culture which is alien but is extremely sympathetic to those that wish to pose a counterculture to the developing European culture. A counterculture to the developing European culture which is based on formalism and classicism, which is based on the beginnings of industrialization. And remember again that any society undergoing industrialization, any society undergoing massive technological change, is bound to be a bewildered society, because one way of life is giving place to another way of life, and it's not really very clear as to where this other way of life is finally leading people. So there is a certain disillusionment with the kind of change that is going on in Europe itself, particularly in the 19th century, the early 19th century, with the beginnings of industrialization. And so you have a kind of bifurcation in attitudes towards the Orient, where people like Herder and Schiller, and even more so the great German poet Goethe, are wildly enthusiastic about things Oriental, and particularly things Indian. In a sense, the further away it is, the easier it is to be enthusiastic, because you don't have the closeness of being able to cross-check your information. And at the same time, there develops a movement against the Romantic movement, critical of the Romantic movement, which is particularly led by a very famous historian called Hegel. Hegel, who was really one of the dominating personalities, intellectual personalities, of Europe, who dismisses the enthusiasm for India by saying it is totally misplaced, that there really isn't a great cultural contribution that the Asian societies have made. In fact, he goes on to say that Asian history has bypassed the mainstream of world history. This is Hegel writing in about 1834. So that there is then this contradictory intellectual ideological battle going on in Europe about attitudes to the Orient. Within the context of the study of India, there are in fact two streams of interest. And these two streams continue all the way through, right up until almost the middle of the 20th century. One is those Europeans who actually went out to India as part of these East India Companies, as officers of the East India Companies. And I should concentrate, of course, only on the English officers, because in a sense their contribution was the greatest, because the English East India Company managed to establish its authority over all the other European East India Companies and became, in fact, the administrator of the land by gradual stages. We find among such officers, and I'm referring to very famous names like Sir William Jones, who was a judge at Calcutta for many years, Colebrooke, Charles Wilkins, H.H. Wilson, Nathaniel Hallhead, all names that are familiar to people who've worked on early texts, the translation of Sanskrit texts, the writing of Bengali grammars, the writing of Tamil grammars, and so on. Officers of the East India Company, who were concerned about the society that they were administering. Who are these people? What constitutes Indian society? What constitutes Indian law? What constitutes Indian religion? They had to be familiar with all this because these were the people that they were governing, and they had to understand all this. So what do? They employ pundits. They employ pundits with whom they go through the ancient texts, either in Sanskrit or in Persian, as the case may be. They employ qazis in the case of Persians. And they translate these texts into English for use by other officers of the company and for use by people back in Europe who are interested in this society. What is interesting about this whole tradition, and remember William Jones is the person who establishes the famous Asiatic Society of Bengal at the end of the 18th century. What is interesting about all these people is that they are working with the pundits for translating the text, but never for a moment do they stop and say to these pundits, what is your view of the world? What does this text really mean? Can you give us your explanation of the text? Never that. It's always a straightforward translation of the text. And the texts that they choose also are very interesting. They translate all the Dharma Shastras, the texts on the so-called legal code. Now, we all know, of course, that the Dharma Shastras were not, in fact, legal codes. They were simply compilations of customary law. Given a certain situation, how does a Brahmin behave? How is a Kshatriya supposed to behave? How is a Vaishya supposed to behave? How is a Shudra supposed to behave? But the translation and the understanding of these texts, then, was one by which the British administration began to argue that this is actually how society functioned. And given a problem, this is the way in which that problem was actually solved. So there is a complete confusion between the compilation of customary laws and theoretical ideals, which is what the Dharma Shastras contain, and the attitude which many of these officers had coming out of a European legal system based on Roman law, that this in fact was functioning law, and this is the way in which society functioned. Inevitably, there was a confusion between the ideal, the actuality, and a confusion between assuming that actually Indian society functioned in the way in which it is described in the Dharma Shastras. There is also a great deal of interest in the religious literature, an interest which is, of course, encouraged by Christian missionary enterprise, which argues that these religions in India are extremely backward religions, primitive religions, and the salvation of Indian society lies in rapid conversion to Christianity. An attitude which, incidentally, many Hindu groups today have taken up with great effect when they go into tribal areas, where you have a number of Hindu missionary, quote-unquote, groups that go into central India and go into northeastern India, look upon the local people with total contempt and try and convert them to what they call Hinduism, so that it's a teaching from the Christian missionaries which has obviously borne fruit in a different context. The other group of people working on things Indian were scholars in Europe, people like Franz Bopp, a very famous Sanskritist, and of course the very well-known Max Müller. Very interesting character because he's full of all kinds of contradictions, and I gather that you've been subjected to a lot of Freudian interpretations the last week, and I think that Max Müller would be one of the most interesting subjects for a Freudian analysis. A man who is obsessed about the greatness of Vedic culture, yet refuses to visit India. He had ample opportunities to come, but he absolutely rejected every opportunity to come. And I think that this in itself is a very interesting light on the way in which he relates himself to Indian studies. These two streams then go into the making of what is called Orientalist scholarship. Scholarship which is based substantially on the pre-modern Indian tradition, the pre-British, pre-European Indian tradition, which it studies very carefully, which is tinged largely by scholars who are trying to get away from industrial change in Europe. There is a very strong element of escapism in Orientalist scholarship. And by this what I mean is that, for example, Max Müller is certainly creating a kind of utopia out of his Indian studies. He reads the Vedic texts and he argues that 19th century Indian society, which is contemporary Indian society, he was a man of the 19th century, is in fact the same. It hasn't changed, he argues. The Vedic texts are a description of the way in which village life carries on in the India of today. There is the creation then of what one might call a continuing romantic construct about Indian society and particularly about the Indian village. There is talk about the village community, which is a community of extremely integrated, harmonious, well-knit social groups living in total harmony, in total passivity. They have no aggression, they have no hostility, it is a perfect society. They're all little autonomous republics, they govern themselves, they know what to do with themselves, they don't have these big fancy state systems, they don't have a church and an authoritarian religion, and it is really the construction of an idyllic society. This construction, just to add a political dimension to it, is encouraged by colonial rule at this time, that is the end of the 18th century, the very early 19th century, because the East India Company and colonial policy at this time was, let's not interfere with this society. Our business is simply to cream off the revenue, whether it is the opium trade, whether it is the production of agricultural revenue. We cream off the revenue, we use it the way we wish to use it, the revenue from trade in the same way. Let's not interfere with this society. Let's just try and understand it in our terms and leave them alone to carry on the way they're going because they are providing what we require. So that is the first attitude of colonial powers towards this. Orientalism also brings about, partly as a result of this kind of thinking, partly otherwise, a very famous theory which becomes absolutely axiomatic to the study of particularly ancient Indian history, even in fact becomes axiomatic to the way in which we Indians today look at our past and look for our own roots and look for our own identity, which is of course something that we're going through all the time. This is the famous theory of Aryan race. A theory which is entirely the invention of European thinkers. It begins with the ideas of a very famous Frenchman called Gobineau, who writes a book called The Essay on Man. And in this book, he tries to analyze the constitution of European society. And he divides it into two groups, the Aryan and the non-Aryan. And he argues that the European aristocracy are all descended from pure Aryan groups, and the European peasantry And by peasantry, he's also including this grappling middle class in the middle of the 19th century that is trying to move up the social scale, are descended from mixed groups and are therefore non-Aryan. This theory is picked up very avidly by a number of European scholars, particularly in Germany and in Northern Europe, where it is argued that the fairer you are, because the purest Aryan was, you know, the tall, fair, blue-eyed, blonde-haired, long-nosed creature, the fairer you are, the more pure is the Aryan constituent of your ethnic composition. And consequently, the Nordics, the Scandinavians and the Germans, were the pure Aryans, and as you come down south in Europe, there is greater and greater intermixture. But this theory of the Aryan versus the non-Aryan was then taken up and taken into linguistics with the search for the Aryan homeland. And it was argued that perhaps this original homeland goes back to somewhere in either Central Europe or Central Asia. Why Central Asia? Because at the end of the 18th century, people like William Jones and a couple of other scholars had argued that languages such as Sanskrit, Greek, Latin, and a whole range of other European languages had a common ancestor. They all grew out of a single common language, a single common root language, and they called this ancestral or root language Indo-European. Indo-European because Sanskrit and Avestan also in ancient Iran had to be incorporated, and then of course the whole spread of European languages. They also argued, and this is really where this theory becomes pernicious, they also argued that people who spoke these languages all belonged to the same racial group. In other words, it ceased to be just a description of languages, it also became a description of racial origins. Now, this is something which was disastrous because although by the 1870s, even Max Müller realized that this argument made no sense and therefore went back on this argument and repeatedly said that it doesn't mean that people who spoke the Indo-European languages were all racially the same or came of the same racial stock. By then the theory had taken root. And all over Europe it was argued that people who spoke the same languages and had access to these languages in their ancient cultures were of the same racial stock. Now, by way of explanation as to why this is a very dubious theory, let me give you the possible example of the United States of America in AD 4000. 2000 years from now, archaeologists and people in linguistics are busy digging up the origins of, not the origins, but the condition of American culture, United States culture, in the 20th century AD. Now, if they were to argue that everybody that spoke American English ipso facto belonged to the same racial stock, you can see the kind of problems that they would run into. And this is precisely...
Excuse me, I think in the old days, in the earlier the period which you are referring to, the possibility of communication was much less, and therefore the process of natural processes were more pronounced. And perhaps that is why they have said the people who are more spoken speaking these Indo-European languages must have come from a common stock, though the languages might have come to be spoken by others who do not belong to the races. I think there would be a small grain of truth in it.
It's very unlikely, because even in that period, the amount of communication was quite extensive. The intermixing was quite extensive. And that is really where archaeological evidence has been of great help to us in explaining movements of people in many parts. The other point, of course, is that today historians look upon language as simply one indicator of a cultural system. And therefore, precisely what you said, that many people belonging to a totally different racial stock would pick up that language for a whole variety of reasons unconnected with just the linguistic or the racial reason. And consequently, the history of language takes on a different dimension altogether. And this theory, in fact, is being questioned quite extensively now because of the fact that you can no longer reconstruct this period only on the basis of linguistic evidence. You have to take into account archaeological evidence as well.
And paleoclimatology also.
After a point, paleoclimatology also. But certainly the archaeological evidence of the migrations of people and the reasons why people moved and the way that where they settled and why they settled and so on, this is extremely important, and therefore it questions this theory. But the main point that I'm trying to argue is that once you equate language and race, then you're really in very serious trouble as far as the history of India is concerned, because the equation that was made originally by these scholars was that race explains caste society as well, that each caste is a separate identifiable race, so that the Brahmins are constituted of one race, the Kshatriyas of another, the Vaishyas of another, the Shudras of another, and so on and so forth. And this was the reason why, in fact, there was a great emphasis laid on physical anthropology right through the late 19th and the early 20th century, where there was a great deal of measuring of heads and marking on skin color and hair color and length of nose and so on, until it was finally given up in terms of the racial identity of caste when it was discovered that, in fact, for example, your Brahmin caste, the distribution right through the Indian subcontinent, most Brahmins have a much greater affinity with the local regional type rather than with this mythical Brahmin construct which had been suggested earlier on. Nevertheless, the theory of Aryan race becomes a very basic theory to Indian history, and it is argued that the beginnings of Indian history go back to the Vedic period, where there is a bifurcation between the Aryans and the Dasas. This is based on the hostility between what is described as the Arya in the Rig Veda and the Dasa, forgetting, of course, that the actual meaning of the word Arya is not a racial entity. This is the reading of people like Max Müller into the Vedic texts. Arya simply means someone who is to be respected, someone who is of high status, who is to be respected, and the reasons for that respect may have to do with 101 other things, and least of all with skin color or color of eyes or whatever. Nevertheless, this becomes a basic theory. It is a division that is accepted right through for many, many decades, and it gets even more complicated when you have people arguing that the Dasas are in fact the Dravidians, so that the Aryan-Dravidian dichotomy, which is certainly not a dichotomy that is available to us from the Indian texts, is a dichotomy which gets firmly established in the 19th century with, of course, as we know, very interesting political results in the 20th century. Now, the Orientalist scholarship is then one stream of scholarship that is going on. Sometime around the first third of the 19th century, there is a change that is introduced. Another group of scholars moves in and has a very different attitude to the interpretation of the Indian past. And I'm here referring to scholars who were influenced by a very famous philosophical school that was predominant in Britain in the 19th century, particularly the early 19th century, the utilitarian philosophy of Jeremy Bentham and others. And it is under the aegis of this philosophy that you get the writing of the first history of India from this modern point of view, the famous History of British India, as it is called, by James Mill, written over a period of years from 1818 to 1823. Extremely important, because it is Mill who sets the foundations for many attitudes that develop later on towards the Indian past, some attitudes which we are trying desperately these days to question and challenge and change, but without too much success. First of all, it is James Mill who periodizes Indian history into what he calls Hindu civilization, Muslim civilization, and British rule. Interestingly, not Christian civilization, but British rule. This periodization, this division of Indian history, which is, again, not based on anything that the Indian texts tell us, but is based on the ideas of James Mill, is a periodization which still is continued in many universities of this country, And I must confess, I get very upset when people quote the Hindu period and the Muslim period at me, because it really is a periodization that has very little validity, in fact has no validity at all, as I hope to show in a later lecture. His major attack is on Hindu civilization, which he says is irrational, superstitious, it's not really a religion, it can't be seen as a religion, it's just a bunch of sects and cults and so on, with nothing very much in terms of an organized religion. It is backward and it is stagnant. Now, stagnancy, standing still, a society that hasn't changed, was common to the Orientalists as well. They also talked about Indian society being unchanging, which is why Max Müller uses the Vedic texts to tell us what is happening in villages in the 19th century. The only difference is that the Orientalists go on saying it was an unchanging society, but it was a beautiful, harmonious society. The utilitarians say it was retrogressive, it was backward, it was full of aggression, it was nasty, brutish, irrational. But it was unchanging and therefore it was stagnant. So you get the positive and the negative side of unchangingness, but they both insist on the lack of change. Mill is a great advocate of the need to change this society. He says that the backwardness of Indian society can only be broken by one thing, and that is legislation. Like all utilitarian thinkers, he's a great believer also in legislation. The British have to legislate change. The British have to bring in change and completely alter, as it were, the premises of Indian society if it is to move from being a stagnant, backward, irrational society into becoming a rational society. He also argues that the main description of Indian society was based on what is called Oriental despotism. And I will explain this concept in a moment. These kinds of ideas, of course, coincided very nicely with contemporary British missionary points of view, that Christianity was the only solution, that the British administration had to intervene and had to do something to break the stagnancy of Indian society. It coincided, incidentally, also very neatly with the views of philosophers of history such as Hegel, who argued that societies like India were irrelevant to world history and once again could only be brought into the mainstream of world history if their basic fundamental structures could be changed. And this attitude also ties in, perhaps not accidentally, with 19th century colonial policy, which changes. The British are now no longer interested in just creaming off the revenue from the surface of wherever they are. They are now interested in changing the economic structure of the colony of India, because industrialization is moving much faster in Britain. There is a greater need for resources, raw materials, and also a greater need for markets where finished products can be sold. And consequently, one of the changes that takes place, for example, is the great expansion in the cultivation of cotton, because raw cotton is then taken to England where it is converted into cloth and brought back and sold. Consequently, British colonial policy at this time is also very anxious to change the structure of Indian society. And therefore, official attitudes go along with this theory that in fact, this was a stagnant society which had to be changed. Official attitudes are also interested in the whole question of Oriental despotism, the ownership of land, the organization of political control at the level of the village. Was there really a village community? Were there really autonomous village republics that were more or less self-sufficient? And also an interest in what is sometimes described as India's present is Europe's past. That what the Europeans found in India or in Asia was, in a sense, the early kinds of societies that they imagined existed in Europe in the years 1000 BC or whatever it may be. This notion of the village community, for example, was a very dominant notion in terms of this is how societies began, and there must have been these village communities all over. But the major theory is that of Oriental despotism, a theory which those of you that might have read something on recent views on Oriental despotism will find still holds, not very widely, but as we shall see at some stage, that it still continues to be a popular notion with a lot of scholarship outside Asia. What did Mill mean by Oriental despotism, and what did this theory imply? The theory maintains that the king owns the land. There is no private property in land. All land is owned by the king. The king controls his ownership of land through a bureaucracy. His contact with the peasantry, which cultivates the land, is through a bureaucracy. The climatic conditions are arid, an arid countryside, a very dry climate. Consequently, agriculture is only possible if there is irrigation. And it is the business of the bureaucracy to provide irrigation, what a recent writer on the subject has called the hydraulic machinery. And it is this hydraulic machinery which is the clue to the mechanism by which the despotic king, through an equally despotic bureaucracy, can control an oppressed peasantry. The peasants are cultivators providing a surplus to the despot. Very important, because all the wealth is collected at the peak of this pyramid, this political pyramid, and this accounts for the fact that right through the history of Europe, India was always